Welcome to the IT Experience Podcast. This is a podcast for those who are interested in IT experience management in large enterprises. If you use ServiceNow or other enterprise service management system to provide services to employees, then this is for you. Brought to you by Happy Signals. More smiles, less time wasted.
Hello and welcome to the IT Experience Podcast. Today we have with us Claire Agutter, and I will let her do the introduction herself. So Claire, who are you? What do you do and where do you come from?
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me onto the podcast. So my name's Claire Agutter. I'm based in the UK and I've spent my entire career in the service management arena. So started on the help desk like a lot of people do, you know, no intention to actually come into the IT industry. I came from retail originally, but then moved into a change analyst role and into change management. And that was when I first discovered ITIL. That was ITIL version 2, which was a revelation for me. And I thought, this is absolutely amazing. And everything kind of progressed from there. So moved into roles where I was helping organizations adopt service management, then into consultancy, then into training and education. And 17 years ago now, I founded my first business, which was a training company. And then 6 years ago, I founded Scopism, which is my second business. And the vision behind Scopism was to support service management professionals, because as my career evolved, service management evolved as well. And things got a lot more complicated. You know, when I was starting out, it was pretty much just ITIL and PRINCE2. And ITIL had, I think, 11 processes at the time. And now the world is so much more complex. And there's things like DevOps, there's Agile. Digital transformation has meant the role of IT is so much more important. And what we do with Scopism is we focus in the service integration and management space, so SIAM. And I think we're going to touch on that soon in terms of what it actually is. But really the key is that we exist to help service management professionals and to help companies get more value from the money that they spend on IT, which is often quite considerable now.
So it's a long time since you started in SIAM, and ITIL was a revelation. What was the revelation that then you understood that there is a need for SIAM? What was that impetus or that trigger that got you going on this path?
It's about that evolution of how IT services are procured and built and then operated and run within organizations. So I think it's important to kind of be clear about the fact that I didn't invent SIAM. We don't own SIAM. SIAM is something that evolved very naturally from the IT industry itself, and in particular the public sector in the UK. And really, it kind of maps onto the evolution of outsourcing. So public sector bodies have a very clear directive that they need to demonstrate value from the money that they spend. And with IT, what initially happened was we had these really large monolithic outsourcing contracts. So you would just get your whole IT, bundle it up and pay a provider to do it for you, which does deliver some value. But then what organizations were finding is some elements were working better than others. So you might be getting amazing value for money in terms of hardware provision and support, but then the software side of it wasn't working really well. So these big monolithic contracts started to be broken up. And at the time, it was the National Health Service and the Department for Work and Pensions in the UK started to think about, wouldn't it be better if we could work with best of breed suppliers in each area? So rather than have one big contract, we've got more and more smaller contracts. And initially they were called towers. So we have, you know, a hardware tower, a software tower, networks, whatever it might be. And again, benefits came, but also the complexity increased, because suddenly you're not managing one service provider, you might be managing 5 or 10 or 20. And then the challenge is, how does all that work together? It becomes a much more complex environment. So the SIAM kind of evolved, and that the concepts were initially suggested by UK government. But then what happened is some of the larger service providers looked at this and said, oh, actually, this is something that we think we can create and we can sell. We can sell you a service integrator who will come in and manage all of that complexity for you. And then as I was founding Scopism, one of the things that I could see was, you know, that the potential for SIAM was huge. The value that it could deliver was huge, but there wasn't anything really available. So if you were a service manager and you thought, oh, I wonder if SIAM's right for my organization, there wasn't a book to read, or, you know, you could find some blog articles maybe on the big service provider sites, but there wasn't anything to really help you get started. So what we did with Scopism was we pulled together a big group of professionals. So large companies, small companies, supply side, customer side, and we wrote the SIAM body of knowledge. And the key with that was to try and codify some of the key concepts so that as a professional, somebody could take that body of knowledge and say, okay, so, you know, what is it? What are the roles, the benefits, the challenges? What does the implementation roadmap look like? And really things kind of spiraled from there. So after the body of knowledge, we then had a partnership with Exyn to offer training and certification. We started running events. We launched an online community. So I guess that's a long answer, but the short answer to the question is, you know, I could see this evolution of service management. I could see how important it was in the way that services are now sourced and delivered, and value is offered to the end consumer. And I wanted to create something that would allow organizations to take advantage of it and understand it. And, you know, 6 years later, that's where we are.
It sounds a little bit like the journey that experience management in IT has taken is that there are concepts and principles that are hovering around, but it hasn't been formalized yet. Or if it has been formalized, it's been done in silos.
Mm-hmm.
So SIAM has been around now for a while, and Scopism has been doing a great job in that area. Why do you think it still works? You mentioned that it was sort of invented a long time ago. Have the challenges and the benefits of SIAM remained the same? And is it still as applicable today as it was when it was first thought of by the UK government?
Yeah, it's funny because we talk about a long time, and, you know, SIAM's been around almost 20 years, which in IT terms is a long time, but in terms of behavioural change and organisational change, it's a tiny amount of time. And I think it's, you know, we're continually as an industry, I think, looking for new things that will help us do better, which is brilliant. But sometimes we kind of jump from thing to thing, that's a bit of a dangerous trend in an organisation. But the benefits of SIAM are still very relevant, because the sourcing life cycle, I guess, eventually we'll come to a point where companies go, actually, you know, we're going to bring it all back in-house and manage it ourselves. But at the moment, for most organizations, their IT estate is backed up by lots and lots and lots of different service providers and suppliers, internal teams, external teams. So the benefits that SIAM delivers are still very, very valid. What's changing is the level at which SIAM is applied and its reach within the organization. So initially the focus was very much on these towers, these large, still fairly large contracts and segmenting up the IT estate. And what we're seeing now is, as I guess IT becomes more embedded across the organization, is we're seeing gradually SIAM becoming a more strategic approach. So rather than thinking about how do we coordinate an incident across these five different companies, or how do we manage change across 10 different service providers? Organizations are looking and saying, how do we now create an operating model? How do we create a strategic sourcing policy that is going to allow us to continually benefit from a moving supplier landscape? You know, we might want to work with a tiny organization on something very specific. How easy is it for us to add and remove them to our organization? So it's extending out into areas like procurement, into legal, because it's not just an IT thing. And I think to kind of give an example of that, coming from my training business side of things, you know, we've had companies that have been desperate to work with us. They want our product, they like our values, but for whatever reason, we don't meet the criteria for the type of supplier that we want to work. They want to work with, you know, maybe we're not big enough, or we don't have an office in a particular country. And anything like that impedes value. It creates friction. It creates barriers. So what we're seeing now is organizations looking at how do we develop an operating model that allows us to leverage best of breed services from whoever we want to, whenever we want to, and how do we make that easy?
So you mentioned the word operating model several times. Would you say that Siam, at its core, because there is the procurement side, there's the legal side, there is the integration and working with others, but is it really about the operating model? Is that the heart of Siam?
It's a chicken and egg question, I think, and it's one we're doing a lot of thinking about within our Siam community and with our Siam Leadership Council at the moment, because operating model discussions are strategic level discussions, are about how do we structure and manage and govern our organization. And if I'm going in and talking to people at the board level of an organization, do they really want to hear about Siam any more than they want to hear about ITIL or particular types of technology? Not necessarily. So I think what the operating model discussion allows us to do is to talk about strategic sourcing. It allows us to talk about organizational transformation. And Siam, for me as a methodology, is just part of what you use to help you deliver that. So once we understand where we want to be as an organization, we can plug in Siam, we can plug in ITIL, we can plug in experience management, whatever it might be. These are the things that we use to help us achieve those goals. So in my mind, the operating model is the kind of the overarching decisions that we make, and then we draw on different things in order to help us achieve the results.
I would like to pick up on what you said there, that if you go to on a board level to talk about Siam, do they really want to speak about Siam or ITIL? What do they want to speak about? Like, what is your experience in when you speak at that high level in the organization? What is the good level between strategic, operational, and tactical? Or what are the, maybe just a simple question, what do they want to talk about?
If I think private sector, if I look at a lot of organizations that I speak to, they want to know, how do we make more money? And, you know, how do we deliver better services? How do we maybe deliver things faster? They want to talk about results. You know, they've developed a strategy that says, this is the type of organization that we want to be. So it's kind of the, where do we want to go is where those senior level conversations happen. And then behind the scenes, as you sort of drop down to the more tactical levels, you start asking and how are we going to do that? And then the operation level, it's kind of, and how do we manage that? And what are the roles and what's the structure that's going to underpin it? But I think it's kind of going in backwards to go to an organization and say, you need to adopt Siam, or you need to adopt Cobit or Prince2 or whatever it might be, because, like, why? because I think it's talking about results and maybe understanding that what got us to where we are now won't necessarily get us to where we want to be in the future.
That's not an easy task, I suppose, because then the interest and the incentives at the different levels. So board level, where do we want to go? And then maybe less interested in how it's going to be done. And maybe that gets just go and figure it out type of mandate then to the different teams and departments within the company. What do you do to get this right then? How much of it is contractual? What do you do? Like, how do you get it right?
Honestly, if I developed the perfect formula for that, I'd be on a luxury island somewhere, I think. There's a big focus in SIAM on building a culture of communication and collaboration. And I think that is about as good a start point as you can possibly have. So if I think about my experience of where things have gone well and where things haven't gone well, when things don't go well, it tends to be because there's this disconnect between the layers in an organization. So for example, you hear about a lot of companies where the senior management team is slashing the IT budget, but at the same time, they're saying to the IT department, you need to be doing more, you need to be doing better. And immediately you've got two things that just don't match together. If you want IT to do better, you need to invest in IT or optimize your IT spend. Equally, if you are just making a blanket statement about we're going to cut 25% of your budget, which is what one organization I was working with did, how is the IT department going to be able to respond to that? Because all they're going to be looking at is, oh, well, you know, we can save a bit of money here, we can save a bit of money here, we can cut headcount here. So a lot of it for me is this congruence between the levels of the organization. And I think that we see some fairly poor examples in the tech industry of organizations that espouse values that they then don't reflect in how they treat their people or how they behave from a corporate perspective. And for me, it works when all the layers of the organizations are aligned at the operational level. People have autonomy to act, but understand the boundaries of that autonomy, and they're not frightened to say, this didn't work, or this is wrong, you know, this is incorrect. And then that goes up to another level. And we've got in the UK at the moment, there's kind of a really horrific example of this with our post office and their outsourced IT system, which was making money disappear. And people working in the post office, some of them went to prison, you know, some people lost relationships, lost families. And it's kind of there's a lot of people talking about that like it's an IT problem, but it's not an IT problem, it's a culture problem, because somebody somewhere was passing up information and then deciding to lie about it or to hide it in order to kind of keep the top of the organization in ignorance. And that's when it really doesn't work. And with the way that IT is embedded in the business now, the consequences can be fairly horrific.
Yes. That cultural aspect, I mean, we do see that in terms of experience management as well, and using a metric as simple as how do people feel about IT, it sometimes requires the culture to be very trusting and no finger pointing. How does SIAM tackle a situation where 25% of the budget is slashed and you need to actually choose how are we going to do it and still maintain a good level of service? What are the mechanisms in SIAM that then enable that conversation in a constructive way?
So, I mean, within a SIAM model, it would be the top level customer organization that owns the contract would be the one that made that decision. And, you know, we'll park the fact that it's not a great decision, but we'll assume that that's what's been handed down. And then the role of the service integrator that's governing these end-to-end service providers would be to look for opportunities to collaborate and perhaps find these cost savings, these cost optimizations between the service providers. And if we think about incentives, because one of the things that we sell as a benefit of SIAM is all of the different service providers understand their piece of the big picture. They can feel confident in the level of demand that they're getting. They can feel confident to innovate and to try new things. And that creates kind of a virtuous cycle where the service providers feel comfortable committing some spend because they know that they've got that assured demand in the future. And what I would expect to see there is that cross service provider conversation about, well, have we got any overlaps we can identify? Have we got anything where perhaps two of our service providers could partner? Have we got any inefficiencies that we can find? Is there anywhere we can look at introducing some automation? So it's going to be an optimization, I think. There's no way to look at your end-to-end supply chain and go, right, well, we don't need that 25%. We've not really been using that. But the service integrator can help look for opportunities for optimization and for innovation, and, you know, can show that big picture and show the importance of everything. Because quite often the bits of IT that get cut are the bits that we really need. So for example, when you've got a really big project and you're running out of time and you're running out of budget, it's the testing element that gets squeezed because that's at the end, so we can just chop that off. And then the problems that go into live are just horrendous and cost you more money to remediate than, you know, you would have spent on the testing. But if you can look at that from a service integrator perspective and say, well, you know, we have this service provider doing testing, quality assurance. They are expensive, but look at the cost avoidance that they're generating for us. And I guess in a perfect world, there's an opportunity for pushback as well to say, you know, we can find you 10%, but 25%, you're going to experience some drops in service levels. And that's something that you need to accept.
And I can imagine that it's also a hard conversation, because if you need to cut budgets, something needs to go.
Mm-hmm.
And you speak about the service integrator's role. Is that usually one person? Is it a committee? Is it a representation of all the different service providers in some sort of meeting? Or what? How do you define the service integrator?
So the service integrator structure will depend on the type and size of the organization. So it's a logical concept, and the customer organization that's building its SIAM ecosystem, normally because they've recognized that they're not getting the value from their IT spend that they should, they have kind of a decision to make about, is this something we want to try and set up ourselves? Or is this something that we actually want to outsource? So if the customer organization says, we're going to do this ourselves, that's absolutely fine. And you know, looking at the research that we do, it's actually a really popular option. But what they need to then do is ensure that there is the level of independence for the service integrator, because the service integrator needs to sit between the service providers and the customer organization. And the service providers need to feel confident that they can say challenging things and that will be managed, escalated to the customer organization where appropriate. So it can absolutely be done internally, and it can be small team, large team, depending on the scope that's been defined for the role. But it needs to have that level of independence. And then there is an option to outsource it as well. So on the larger contracts, quite often the customer will choose to work with one of the really big service providers, you know, Infosys, HCL, TCS, Deloitte, all the companies of that size have service integrator offerings. So you have that guaranteed independence and you have the benefit of their experience because they should have done this with multiple other clients. The challenge that sometimes brings is then the competitive tension. So, you know, maybe Deloitte, for example, are the service integrator and Atos, Fujitsu, HCL, Infosys, Wipro are delivering services. But then elsewhere in the market, these companies are competing against each other. So again, the way that the service integrator is structured, the independence around it and the sort of the perception of impartiality is really, really important.
And I can imagine that that perception of impartiality is challenged sometimes when sort of push comes to shove and you do have a limited budget. And if you know that you can provide all of these services, but the service integrator says, no, we believe that it's actually better that the other ones provide this part because of X, Y, and Z. How do you objectively then show that you are impartial? And how do you objectively measure the performance of the different service integrators? Are there metrics? Is that a conversation? Is that a peer review? Like, how does that work to understand if the chosen model and the chosen service providers are the right ones?
It's a combination of a lot of different things. And one of the key things is to start from the right foundations. So that means choosing service providers and a service integrator that are culturally aligned with what you want to do as an organization, and then having contracts in place that specify the behaviors that are required, the things that are maybe different from a normal outsource contract. Because for example, in a CIAM model, in a typical outsource, if a service provider doesn't meet its targets, it'll pay a penalty. Whereas in a CIAM model, what you might have is if a service provider doesn't meet its targets, it's a notional penalty. And the requirement is for that service provider to reinvest in its services and, you know, look for why this happened and what could be done to improve it. And that might involve working with another service provider. So it's the contracts. And one of the challenges that we find is when we're not operating in a greenfield environment. So you have existing service providers and the contracts maybe aren't aligned and the culture isn't aligned. But that's the start point. And then what happens after that is, you know, it's just hard work and people, you know, people are some of the most amazing and frustrating parts of the systems that we work with. But when I was working in a service integrator role back on the UK's National Health Service, a lot of it was just meetings, talking, building relationships, building trust. And one of the things that we have in the CIAM body of knowledge is this concept of how these relationships change over time. So at the beginning, the level of trust is low. And then hopefully over time, as you all invest in the relationships, that increases. But then, you know, maybe a key person leaves. So that level of trust drops again, and then somebody new's imposed and you've got to build it up. So a lot of it is just finding the structures, finding the ways that will build this culture. And we have examples in the body of knowledge about, you know, process forums and governance boards, just to bring in this cadence of kind of regular communication. But it's definitely something that has to be worked at. And of course, now with the sort of the global economy that we're in, a lot of people working from home more, that does bring some additional challenges, because you may never sit in the same room together as these people you're trying to build the relationships with. So you need to find ways to adapt to that as well.
And I think the way that you describe a CIAM working and what kind of conversations and hard conversations need to be had, building relationships, building trust over time. This is a question that we get quite often, is that we want to hire somebody. Mm-hmm. We want them to be responsible for IT experience, for example, across a number of different teams and departments and locations and markets. And their work is often quite similar. They need mm-hmm. to have those conversations, need to build trust, get those teams to think that and believe in that it is actually worth looking at experience rather than sticking to the old and familiar SLAs and IT KPIs that they've learned to keep green no matter what happens. In your experience, what are the type of people or characteristics or skills that are good to look out for when thinking about who would be right for this role, or an individual or individuals? What are the sort of characteristics that make for a good person to drive these SIAM initiatives?
It's a brilliant question, and I'm sure that the skills are very similar to these experience management people that you're talking about, because it is all about the people skills. It's communication skills. It's high levels of personal integrity. It's being willing to have the difficult conversations. And you kind of mentioned there this idea of keeping your metrics green no matter what happens. And I think it's something that we see in the SIAM space as well, in the outsourcing space, because people don't want to have the difficult conversations. They don't want to say, well, actually, this month, this is red, and what are we going to do about it? And more to the point, is it going to cost us any money, kind of thing? So it's very much about finding the right person. There's qualifications that people can get, you know, the SIAM Foundation, SIAM Professional Certification that people can do to understand the method, and it gives them tools that they can use. But ultimately, it's about the people side of things. And for me, recruiting into that type of role, it's find the right person, and you can train the tools and the techniques and the little things about the organization and the setup, but it's finding the right person. And it's challenging, and I've got it wrong. You know, everybody puts their best face forward in an interview, and then sometimes what you find after 1 month, 2 months, 3 months isn't quite what you'd hoped. There's no magic formula yet for recruitment, but for me, it's looking across somebody's career, somebody's experience, to look for these examples of managing challenging situations, building relationships, building a network. All of these things you can look for. I think there's a lot of alignment with business relationship management as well. So I think there's a lot of crossover there in terms of the type of skills that people have.
I remember this one anecdote. There was one of our customers in the UK was hiring people for their experience management and IT teams to look at the data and then be the intermediaries. Mm-hmm. And they had this strategy of hiring unusual profiles. And for example, one of the best people was a former flight attendant.
Okay.
And it sort of makes sense, because if you're a flight attendant or a steward or working in an airplane, you're going to be facing all kinds of different people, easy ones, difficult ones, the ones who panic in the air. And you always need to keep your calm. So it's almost like you speak about this personal integrity. And I think maybe coming back to that, how does that integrity sort of express itself in those? Like, how can they be impartial? Because they are still paid for by one of the parties, and they need to still be impartial with everyone. So do you want to go a little bit into like what that looks like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny you should mention that, because our help desk team leader that we used to have used to work in the first class cabin in Emirates, and her customer service was astonishing. She, you know, she could handle every single situation, every type of customer. And then when she went on maternity leave, the gentleman that we've got at the moment, his experience is from hospitality. And he's done things like working as a butler in the sort of the suites out in the Middle East. So, yeah, completely agree with that. And I think that a retail background or a customer service or a hospitality background equips you for an awful lot in the professional world. And, you know, I count my service desk years towards that as well. But I think coming back to the integrity question, the key thing for me, and this, I don't think this is exclusive to SIAM. I think it's something that, you know, it's coming into the IT service management space. I expect it's there in the experience management space. But the key thing for me is to be able to focus on the result, the goal, the vision, the mission, the objective, whatever it might be, and to look at the entire ecosystem, no matter how complex it is, as elements that help us get towards that vision, that mission, and removing anything personal from the conversations that we need to have. So we talk a lot now about things like psychological safety within organizations, you know, being able to fail, not having fear of failure. And it's that mindset shift when something goes wrong, to not say, whose fault was this? You know, who do we get rid of? Who do we punish? To say, what happened? Why? Is there anything we can do to prevent this happening again? And removing the element of finger pointing. And it's kind of one of the operational examples that we give for SIAM is when something goes wrong. So, you know, let's say you're trying to use your online banking and it's not available. If you have a group of service providers, because you might have, you know, the website provider, you've got the database in the back end, you've got the access management, you've got loads and loads of different pieces of this complex service that we just take for granted because it's there every day. If all those service providers are frightened that this is going to cost them money, they're going to get into trouble, they will hide information. And if you can create a culture where it's actually something's not working, let's all get together and work out how to correct this, then we can have a little look and see if there's anything to improve. It's a very, very different conversation. So the integrity of the service integrator team is manifested through their governance of this approach and their commitment to it, but it's also within the foundations of the structure that's been set up. So it is also related to, you know, the contracts, the culture, the selection process, the culture of the service providers. But, you know, it goes, I think psychologically it goes back to being a child. We didn't want it to get in trouble when we were children, and it's the same in the workplace. I remember one of my service desk jobs was for a big chain of builders merchants, and every now and then the printer in one of the stores would stop working, and from where we were we could do a little reset that would refresh it. And I remember one day I was trying to do the printer for one store, and then I realized what I'd done was I'd reset every single printer in every single store across the UK. So every single store would be experiencing this brief hiccup in their print service. And I just remember sitting there and feeling the blood drain from my face because I thought I was going to get in trouble and, you know, put my hand up. I did this. I'm sorry. It's not the end of the world. You know, don't worry about it. Really, in theory, I shouldn't have had the ability to do that. But we don't want to get in trouble. And even as very seasoned professionals working in incredibly high-powered jobs, there is still that element of, will I get in trouble if I say this? Will I get in trouble if I do this? And we have a duty, I think, to build systems that allow people to express themselves safely.
I wonder how. So let's try to a little bit like push you to and maybe like try to, you know, poke holes in where are the things in Siam that could be challenging. And I'm thinking, so you have this person that has a lot of personal integrity, manages to create a general culture of trust and taking responsibility without fear of being reprimanded. But then there is the competitive aspect. I mean, you look at the goals, the objectives, and the mission that the organization is trying to reach. Do you sometimes have situations where the different service integrators will sort of unintentionally start competing to be the best service integrators within that model? Or are there reward systems? Or how do you keep it collaborative? And is there a competitive aspect to consider at all?
There is. So what you would typically have is the one service integrator building the relationship across all the different service providers. And some of those are external organizations that have you know, won a contract. Some of them are internal teams. So they might have slightly different incentives. They may be more aligned with the customer organization. But you will reach points where, you know, say, for example, at the moment, you've got one external organization doing software development and another external organization doing software support. And the contract for the software development might be coming to an end. And the software support organization might think, do you know what? We could do development and support. That looks pretty attractive to us. And I'm sure we can make a case for this. So yes, absolutely, that happens. And there are models that introduce a challenger element. I'm on the fence myself as to whether I think this is a good idea. But there are models where work is kind of redistributed depending on the performance of the different service providers. So again, I think that the key thing from the integrator perspective is that transparency and that understanding, and, you know, making sure that these things will happen. So let's recognize them and let's talk about them. But I think one of the nice things that you tend to see when a SIAM model has been set up and is working well is the people who are working on it day to day, the people who are involved, almost lose touch, I think, sometimes with the organizations that employ them. So going back to that organization example of, you know, the software developers and the software support, might be the management of the software support company that's thinking, oh, you know, we like the look of that, we'd like to take that on. But the actual teams that are working on the ground, that are going to the SIAM process forums and the SIAM governance boards, the relationships that are the most frequent for them, you know, the ones that they have the most interaction with, are the ones within the SIAM ecosystem. So they might be spending more time with their competitors than they actually do with the organization that employs them. And sometimes you end up with that bit of distance. You talk about kind of poking holes in SIAM, and that there are lots of examples of SIAM gone wrong, not done well. And I don't want to underemphasize, if that's the word, I don't want to underemphasize how difficult and how challenging this can be and how committed an organization needs to be, because the SIAM transformation can take years. In a way, they never really end, because there's always, you know, new service providers come in, old service providers leave in, the organization itself changes. So it's a commitment, and the level of commitment on the sort of the people, process, and technology levels shouldn't be underestimated. And I think if the senior management attention wanders, then there is absolutely the possibility that the results won't be what were expected and what were hoped for.
As opposed to, you just expressed a perfect example of what that personal integrity looks like. I mean, your career is at the moment anchored in SIAM, And you can sort of just openly say that I don't want to underemphasize how hard it can be.
Yeah.
And there's a sort of a breath of fresh air in a world where a lot of vendors might be selling their product as the magic one that will just make all their problems go away. No, it's fascinating. I definitely know much more about SIAM now, understand more what it is about than I did just less than 1 hour ago. And I hope that our audience can feel the same way. If there are companies and organizations that we want to look into, is SIAM right for us? What would be a good way of reaching out to you or to people that could give them information and maybe go through some sort of initial evaluation if it would be a right fit for them?
Absolutely. So we try and offer as much as possible as freely as possible. So there are a lot of resources that people can access. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter, which I don't want to call X because I don't like it, but I'm still on Twitter. So you can find me on there. I am always willing to have a conversation. And then on the Scopism website itself, you will find a couple of free assessments. So we've got a SIAM readiness assessment, a SIAM health assessment that organizations can take. And then through the website as well, you can also join our online SIAM community, which is completely free to join. And inside there, at the moment, it's expanding every day, but at the moment we've got 1500 people in there who you can ask questions. We've got events that we've run. You can catch up and watch the historical events that we've done. And you'll also find the SIAM Foundation and Professional Body of Knowledge as free downloads, and the research that we've done over the last 5 years as well. So the SIAM Global Survey white papers are in there as well. So that would be the first thing I would recommend. Come to the Scopism website, join the community, just get involved, and the community is absolutely a safe place. So come ask questions, and there will always be people in there who'll be happy to share their experience.
Thank you, Claire, for coming on the show. I really, really enjoyed this conversation, and I wish you a wonderful weekend. It's Friday today as we're recording this. And hopefully I'll speak to you soon again. So thank you for coming. And we always say at the end of the podcast, stay safe and stay happy.
Thank you very much.
If you like this episode, giving the podcast a review helps others find this content as well. You can also visit our YouTube channel or our learning center at happysignals.com for some more video content. Join hundreds of like-minded IT professionals who have passed the free ITXM certification course on itxm.academy.